Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3 years ago, when former U.S. Senators Warren Rudman and Gary Hart warned of a terrorist attack on the United States, nobody listened. Then came September 11th. Now, more than a year after the tragedy, their bipartisan Blue Ribbon Task Force says America is still dangerously unprepared to prevent and respond to a catastrophic terror attack on U.S. soil. The findings are detailed in the just-released report, America Still Unprepared, America Still in Danger, and it is chilling reading. It says America's ports and roadways, refineries, and power plants are, right now, easy targets for terrorists. That Americans have become too complacent about the terrorist threat, that Congress is putting politics ahead of the national interest in addressing terror. And it warns, without aggressive homeland security measures now, laws passed in the wake of the next surprise attack will further curtail our freedoms. The report comes on the heels of warnings to Congress by CIA Director George Tenet that the terrorist threat is as grave now as it was just before the September 11th attacks. And it comes as the focus in Washington moves from the domestic front to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. Have you become complacent about the terrorist threat? Are federal and local authorities doing all they reasonably can and should to make this country safe? What's the holdup? Join us tonight at the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Denver, Colorado, is former Senator Gary Hart. Good evening and welcome, Gary Hart.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Thank you for being with us, and thanks for the new report. It makes a very gripping reading. Are you surprised that a year plus after September 11th, you're having to come out with a report saying, folks, we're still not ready, we're still not prepared?
I would say surprised, yes, but I would say more dismayed. I thought, given the pulling together and the consolidation of the country after the 9/11 attack, that the political structure would move much more quickly, that the private sector would move much more quickly, that that the president would endorse a Homeland Security Department much more quickly, and it simply did not happen.
And here we are. We want to talk about all that tonight, especially, well, both public and private sector. It's very interesting, the points that you raised there. But describe for us, if you would, first, how bad is the situation, in your view? Where do you see the country as being most vulnerable now?
It's more what the terrorism and counterterrorism experts think. And what they think is that, in terms of degrees of vulnerability, and particularly in the transportation sector, it would be our seaports and our coastlines. In the critical infrastructure, it's probably our energy production and distribution systems, because they're so far flung. And in the private and public health care system, it's the inadequacy of those systems to counter biological or chemical terrorist attacks.
Give us a sense, Gary Hart, of what those vulnerabilities are. I mean, we hear that we're vulnerable in our roadways and our railways. You say you had power plants and refineries, but how might those infrastructure pieces be turned into problems?
Well, I think it's pretty self-evident. Somebody blows up an oil refinery or a pipeline, or the list goes on. We don't have enough time this evening to go through all the scenarios. People fly airplanes into buildings. There are all kinds of ways you can hurt this country, and it is up to those whose job it is to protect us in all those sectors to understand those scenarios and prepare for them. Now, there's never going to be absolute security, and no one believes that.
There's too much pipeline out there.
Well, and it's too big a country. We've got 9,500 miles of coastline, 371 ports, 21,000 shipping containers a day come into those ports. And so it's a big, complex country. But I often use a personal illustration. When I was a candidate for national office, the director of the Secret Service said, first of all, if someone wants to kill you, they will probably kill you. Our job is to make it as difficult as possible. So that's what we're saying, is let's make it as difficult as possible.
and conceding that perfect protection isn't possible, how close are we? Are we? I mean, it's hard to quantify, but are we halfway there?
You're asking quantitative questions that I can't answer because there are no numbers that can be put on this.
Well, I guess to put it in qualitative terms, have we? The question a citizen wants to ask is, have we made a reasonable response in the time that we've had? And I guess from the comments that I've seen you quoted making as your report came out, you would say no. You've said that you're outraged at Congress's paralysis.
Congress, and I would say the executive branch as well. By way of illustration, the commission on which I and Senator Rudman and other Americans served recommended to the new president a Department of Homeland Security January 31st, 2001. Mm-hmm. The attack occurred 9 months later, and it took nine more months before the administration finally endorsed that proposal. So a year and a half went by. 5 months after that, we still don't have the department. Now, if you've got time, I'm more than happy to give you my view of why politics in America is paralyzed. This is an illustration of the paralysis of politics.
I guess we can't duck the question. You've said that the government teeters on the brink of being non-functional. This is a front on which we really can't afford that.
Well, that's precisely the point. If this were sort of creating new recreation areas in America, we could debate it endlessly, as we do abortion, gun control, death penalty, and things like that. But we don't have all the time in the world. We have been warned. We've been warned over and over again, and we will be attacked again.
Is it psychological or political? Is there a fundamental complacency?
You're asking a question about the American character that I think it would require probably a PhD thesis to answer. Because we are 280 million people in a representative democracy composed of all sorts of different interest groups and constituencies, it is very, very difficult to get people together. And the moderate consensus for governing America that existed in the Senate when I went there in the 70s has been fragmented by partisanship and ideological conflict and failure of real, genuine national interest leadership. So it really, and Americans are walking away from the government. If they were outraged enough to demand better government, I think they'd get it. But instead of that, they are not voting anymore.
We remember the stories of how Rome was picked apart by the Visigoths when it seemed like it shouldn't be, when it seemed too powerful to be. Do we have that kind of risk here?
Rome died from within. Rome decayed from within.
And the USA?
Well, I don't mean to be apocalyptic, but a mass democracy cannot long survive if people don't vote or participate in the matters that concern them. And nothing concerns people more than their own security and the security of their families. And I think there has been an assumption, because of the burst of energy last year ago, September, that things were being taken care of. And so we waited a few weeks, we waited a few months. Now more than a year has gone by, and essentially what we've said is things are not being taken care of.
But clearly you're putting across the perspective, the point of view here, that there is much more that could reasonably and effectively be done within our resources, within our political structure, within our Constitution. It's not. It's not as though this is helpless. You're saying this is hopeless. There's a lot that could be done that simply isn't.
Well, absolutely. No, I don't think anybody on our commission or on our task force said we're in a hopeless, desperate, inevitably vulnerable situation. No, we can do a lot of things, and not all of them cost a lot of money. For example, one of the recommendations we made was that the 650,000 state and local law enforcement people be put on the watch, have access to the watch list managed by federal law enforcement agencies. That is to say, that they be told who we're looking for. Presently, they are not.
So and they could stop Muhammad Atta and not even know that he needed taking in.
Exactly. And that costs nothing.
Is it difficult organizationally somehow? Why hasn't that been done?
It is bureaucratic thinking. It is Cold War thinking. It is intelligence agencies saying need to know. In the Cold War, if somebody wanted to know what the threat was, you had to prove, you had to demonstrate why you deserve to have that knowledge. And so we still have that that mentality going on 10 years later.
Holding the cards too close to the vest.
Well, I think that's another way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, protecting information. Information is power. And if you're the person in town with the information, everybody's got to come to you. Well, the whole situation is reversed.
Gary Hart, tick off some other key steps that you'd like to see taken that are steps that could reasonably be taken.
Well, let me emphasize once again, it's not me. It's 17 Americans, including two former secretaries of state of both political parties, two former chairmen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, three Nobel laureates, and of some very, very distinguished Americans, Jim Kallstrom from New York, who's one of the top law enforcement officials in the country, and all 17 of us agreed on these things. So,
duly noted.
Let me depersonalize it. It's not what I think. It's what all of us thought. And the experts we dealt with, I think your introduction touched on a number of those, and I've already touched on them. Tighten up port security dramatically.
Is that a mechanical issue? Is that putting new machinery in place?
Part of it's technological. If somebody came up with a device to X-ray or take pictures of the insides of containers, whether on trucks or ships, and could do so speedily, so that it didn't impede traffic and commerce, that would be an enormous breakthrough. Now, I say that every speech I give, and I give dozens, if not hundreds, and more often than not, somebody pops up in the audience and say, my company does that. Well, so part of it is the mismatch.
The capacity's there, but it's not implemented.
Tom Ridge has a small office. When President Bush said September 20th, I am appointing Governor Tom Ridge not to run a new department, but to have an office in the White House, I knew it would be a disaster. Not because of Tom Ridge, but an office in the White House cannot reach out and find all these people.
Gary Hart, stand by. We've got callers who are already lining up and want to join us. Alan's calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air with Gary Hart.
Hi. You know, I don't know if I'm complacent or not. And the reason is that this business of a homeland security has been so politicized by this president, and I'm not sure if the Democrats were in, if it would be that, but I think he likes to focus on this so much as an election issue to divert from other issues.
Do you mean to say you think the threat is being exaggerated, Alan?
Well, see, I don't know. I have no way of knowing that, but I'm on the constant suspicion that that's the case because this president, you know, just seems to want to divert a lot of issues and just talk about this and not others because he does have a tendency to want to focus only on one thing or a few things.
Well, here's a bipartisan panel. Gary Hart, you hear this kind of doubt that maybe the threat is not really that bad. Maybe we're being played here.
I don't think that's what he's saying. He's making a different point. I would probably disagree with it, first of all, because our panel did not try to assess blame. Ironically, within an hour or two, we kept the White House throughout September and October informed of what we were doing. This was not a sneak attack or anything. We told them what we were doing. We let them know what our conclusions were before they were released to the public. But within an hour, some junior spokesperson in Governor Ridge's office said the report was out of date. Well, that's just foolish. That's silly. It's even bad politics. They should have said this is a welcome effort to get the American people behind our effort. So they missed the point.
But you can hear Alan saying, Gary Hart, that he's not sure how fully to swing in behind these kinds of measures because he's not sure if they're being used for political purposes rather than being accurately portrayed.
Well, he said the president's doing that.
Yes.
He didn't say there wasn't a threat. He just said the president was using.
Well, the president's become the chief spokesperson about terror in this country.
But I would – my response is, if my criticism would be that this is a two-front war. It is to go after terrorists where they exist and to protect this country in the meantime. And the two-front war is being waged on one front, namely Afghanistan and now increasingly Iraq. Now let me take 30 seconds to make the strongest point I can make. When we go to war in Iraq, and we are going to, the terrorist threat against this country is going to skyrocket. And we are not prepared for that. And therefore, we should not go to war in Iraq until this country is prepared for that terrorist threat.
That's a pretty strong point, considering how close that war may be. We're talking tonight with Gary Hart about America, the vulnerable, and what hasn't been done in the year since 9/11 to increase homeland security. Do you remember the adrenaline of last fall and the absolute urgent security issues that were on the table then? Do you still feel them now? Have you become complacent? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America, the vulnerable, and what hasn't been done to increase homeland security since last 9/11. My guest tonight is Senator Gary Hart, former Democratic U.S. Senator from Colorado. He has been co-chair, along with former Republican Senator Warren Rudman, of a bipartisan blue ribbon panel that has issued a new report sponsored by the Council on Foreign Affairs called America Still Unprepared, America Still in Danger. What about you? Do you see significant, effective changes in the security of your own community? And what about Gary Hart's point? Is war on Iraq taking our eye off homeland security? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation now Juliet Kayyem. She's executive director of the Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and has been listening. Hello and welcome, Juliet Kayyem.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, thanks. Juliet, you've heard Gary Hart's critique of where the system stands and why more hasn't been done in the year since, and the danger that he sees coming from war with Iraq if we get into it before we've pulled up our socks here at home. It sounds like a pretty dire situation.
Oh, it does. I mean, I think the important part of Senator Hart and Rudman's new report with all the members that he mentioned is, you know, for the average citizen thinking about homeland security, it has got to seem, as compared to those of us who sort of work in the field, it's got to seem so incredibly overwhelming. I mean, and then you talk about things like the Department of Homeland Security, 170,000 employees needing to move into a new department. And it's sort of, you know, what we need most is sort of those hands-on, reasonable efforts that don't take sort of, you know, moving mountains. And I think Hart and Rudman and the Council on Foreign Relations report sort of highlights what some of those efforts can be, can get done. They aren't terribly expensive. Some of them require, you know, technological fixes. Some of them require bureaucratic fixes. But that there are efforts that can be made that aren't, you know, so overwhelming to the average citizen. I think it's something that they can grasp, and that's important because I think one of the reasons why there's no political, or I would say public momentum, you know, that's causing sort of political response is because it's just got to seem so big. I mean, the idea of securing the homeland is never actually going to happen, or even making it more secure as an overwhelming mission. And so in some ways, I think we've got to focus sort of on those, I don't want to say easy, but they're sort of more reasonable responses that I think everyone can get behind. We saw a bipartisan group get behind to make baby steps, maybe the wrong word, but the first steps towards making us more secure. And the other thing is, as Senator Hart said at the very end before you guys went into the break about Iraq, I think that is tremendously true, that the short-term or maybe even the long-term impact of going into Iraq is going to be our greater vulnerability, whether it's from Iraq specifically or because we're going to so disrupt a certain part of the world, Iran, Syria, Lebanon will all sort of, you know,
that more terrorism will emerge.
Right.
Gary Hart, you hear Juliet Kayyem seconding your view there. Right. But yet you say, Senator Hart, that we are on track for war with Iraq, and there's lots of evidence of that. Is this an arrogance of power or again, a kind of disregard for domestic vulnerability?
Well, I always find it difficult to answer questions about other people's motivation. I think you'd have to ask the president that. He is obviously spearheading the effort to have us become engaged militarily with Iraq, and I think he's has to be held accountable for why we should do that. All I'm saying is, if we're going to do it, and he has a resolution from the Congress authorizing him to do it, then we better be prepared here at home. The two things that have not been discussed in this whole debate is the number of casualties, oddly
in Iraq.
And in America, for American troops, and the retaliation against this country by all kinds of interests because of this military initiative. And we're not prepared for that. So the press, or politicians or somebody ought to be asking the president, Mr. President, when retaliation comes, is America prepared for it? And the answer is no.
We don't have the president here tonight, but we have you. How far short of having the resources or the attention span? Another
quantitative question. What can I say? One quarter? I don't know. I mean, I can't.
Let me put it another way then. Can we handle the two fronts that have been opened? As you pointed out, we've got a front abroad and a front at home. Do we have the resources and the mental bandwidth to deal with both?
Yes, of course we do.
But it's a matter of consecutively preparing those.
Not consecutively, simultaneously.
Well, but I guess I also hear you saying we shouldn't be going to war with Iraq because we're not ready on the home front yet.
Right. Well, we maybe shouldn't do it for a whole lot of other reasons, mm-hmm. but one of the reasons that hasn't been discussed is we're not prepared for the retaliation. Mm.
Gary Hart, Juliet Kimel, lots of callers want to join us. Let's turn to them. Thomas is calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. I feel that we're talking about Band-Aids here to a much deeper problem. And the terrorists were from Saudi Arabia. They don't like American troops on their soil. We haven't done anything about that. The troops are still there, and it looks like they're going to stay there. I wouldn't want Saudi Arabian troops on American soil. We haven't done anything about our inconsistent support of... We talk a lot about democracy. Saudi Arabia is not a democracy. How we inconsistently support some governments.
So you're saying, Thomas, we can't hope to be prepared for every kind of terrorist attack, and we need to look at root causes. Gary Hart, how do you parse those two? How do we begin to think about doing both? How's the ratio?
It's not one or the other. You mm-hmm. have to do both. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, regardless of our foreign policy in Israel or troops here or there, there are a group of people in the world, somewhere between 10 and 10,000, that want to kill us. And we could change we could withdraw all of our troops from everywhere, and they hate us. They don't like us. They resent the fact that our popular culture is invading their countries, so on and so forth. Unless we totally withdrew within American shores, and by that I mean our commercial interests as well, that core we've got to deal with, and that's what this task force was all about.
Mm-hmm. Can I pick up on that?
Juliet Kayan?
Yeah, I mean, I think Senator Hart is right in the sense that, I mean, you're looking at a quantifiable number. I mean, there's a debate whether it's, you know, 2,000, 5,000, or 10,000 men who want to attack America for no reason but, you know, sort of this ideological reason, and there's all sorts of explanations for it. And I think since September 11, 2001, we risk finding all sorts of boogeymen everywhere. I mean, if you listen to how we talk about terrorism now, or at least terrorists, you know, it ranges mm-hmm. from what happened last week in Arizona, where the guy walks into a classroom shooting some professors, to even the sniper attacks in D.C., where I think the jury's still out on what that was, to Iraq, to, you know, al-Qaeda. And they're very different threats. And I think one of the things that concerns me in the future is we can't sustain a counterterrorism effort or domestic preparedness against a threat that we're going to ascribe to every bad thing that happens in the world. That we have to remember there's a certain group of men who really want to harm us, and we need to do everything to prevent them from doing that and to also do things to, you know, make our responses better so the least number of Americans would die if they are successful.
Granted, Senator Hart and Rudman seem to be trying to pull our attention down to the basic things we can do to be less vulnerable to exactly that kind of attack.
Well, the commission on which Senator Rudman and I served, mm-hmm. The U.S. Commission on National Security, did take the broader view. And for those who read the report, they know that we talked not only about threats, we talked about opportunity. Mm-hmm. And in the opportunity arena, we talked about the use of diplomacy and economic development to remove the causes of hatred of the West and of the United States particularly by giving people hope and opportunity. And we did so in very, very specific terms. So I would encourage the caller to get a hold of that report, which is still in the public domain, mm-hmm. Because it does respond to his concerns and a lot of people's concerns, including mine. But the most recent task force had to do with that core of people who will not be dissuaded by any changes in our foreign policy or our military policy, for that matter, who are out to kill us.
Gary Hart, there's a portion of your report, the report, that interested me, and I wasn't quite sure I understood what was the energy behind it. You're calling on the private sector to step up and do a lot more, saying it's their patriotic duty for the private sector to be more involved in protecting their operations from attacks. What's that about? Why the private sector?
Well, it's about something called the critical infrastructure primarily, and those are the core industries upon which our society and our nation and our economy are based, and those are usually summarized as including, in no particular order, the financial structure, the energy structure, both production and distribution, transportation, including air, sea, and land, and communications. And 80 to 90% of those systems, and they are big systems, are in private hands. So this is not a situation where the government can, or I suppose the government could if it had all the money in the world, undertake to protect those plants and all that equipment, including distribution lines, communication lines, and so forth, out of the taxpayers' pockets. The private sector has to do some of it. Now, what you find out is that there is legislation proposed to require, for example, the chemical industry to make its plants more secure, because you could put a, set off an explosion in a, I suppose, in a chlorine plant somewhere and kill an awful lot of people, and that's a vulnerability. And the chemical industry is lobbying like mad behind the scenes to kill that legislation. Well, the President of the United States has to call those executives into his office and say, ladies and gentlemen, this country expects you to do your duty as American citizens and protect your plants. Now, if anybody's got a problem with that, I want to hear it right now.
Well, it seems like they are voicing a problem with it, as you say,
well, they're
through lobbyists.
Well, they're doing it behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure they're all out giving speeches to chambers of commerce saying what great American citizens they are, while they're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to Washington lobbyists to kill this legislation.
What's really going on there? Is it a kind of game of chicken where they want the government to come in and protect their industry? Or
you're asking me to tell you about their motives. Ask them.
Well, I'm sure we reach out and talk to everybody, but I bet you have a pretty good idea.
It's about the bottom line. It's about profits. That's not too difficult. I mean, it's about making money. It costs money to build higher fences and to hire more guards and put brighter lights on the perimeters. So if you're out to make money, you're probably not going to want to do that.
Juliet Kayyem, is there a chance that American industry is going to be able to, you know, duck its earnings reports to build this kind of spending on security in systematically, as this report suggests? Is Wall Street going to give them the leeway to spend that kind of money that would require to bring this critical infrastructure into some more protected envelope?
Well, I unfortunately doubt it as well. I mean, in the stuff that we've reviewed since September 11th, you know, the major focus of the private sector has been business continuity. So can they, like what we saw after September 11th, can they reset themselves up, you know, replug in the computers in the event of an attack and get themselves moving again? Can they continue that bottom line? And business continuity is important, of course, but obviously both, you know, they need to protect their people and are things in place to ensure that the people themselves are protected, that they know how to get out of the building and issues like that. And then also, are they taking preventative steps to ensure that their sites are protected? And that's where, as Senator Hart said, you're not seeing much progress. I mean, you can't really rely on the memory of September 11th for much longer than a few weeks, and I think we saw that happen. I mean, look at the airline industry itself. I mean, the airline industry is seeking bailout, really unwilling to commit voluntarily to do some of the security measures, and is just waiting for the, you know, federal check. So, unfortunately, I think that that's symbolic of what's going on.
Victor's calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Victor. You're on the air.
Hello. Good morning. I mean, good afternoon.
Hi, Victor.
Third shift. I'm sorry. But I have a concern. You know, these terrorists are not stupid. They know that we're going to be prepared to protect our airlines, certain strategic spots, you know, nuclear plants, water, and everything. One of my concerns is for the average citizens, the most vulnerable ones, because we think of Americans, we think of somebody healthy that has a chance of probably escaping these situations. I'm thinking about the vulnerable ones, the people that are disabled, the elderly, the public schools, the students, you know, people that we don't think about, that they're vulnerable victims to a terrorist attack.
Well, I guess we're all vulnerable. We saw that on September 11th.
Yeah, but my concern is this. you know, we rely too much on the government. It's there to protect us. But I was wondering, shouldn't we get back to the Cold War, the civil defense, and our public schools, learning it on what to do in situations like that, prepare for and be knowledgeable about it? It may not have much of an effect, but I'm just wondering, should we start relying a lot more on civil defense and educating through the public schools what we should do? Because this is a real issue, just like the Cold War and communism was a real issue.
We've got the question, Victor, and thank you for it. Let me put it to Senator Gary Hart. Senator Hart?
Absolutely. I'd phrase it a little differently. What our task force and our commission said was the frontline defenders here are not, it's not the FBI and the 82nd Airborne Division, it's state and local law enforcement people and emergency medical people in both the public and private sector. This is a curious situation. This isn't like the Cold War. This is a war that's coming to our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are going to be fighting this war are not necessarily FBI agents in the J. Edgar Hoover building in Washington. They're going to be cops on the beat in Denver. They're going to be the Denver Fire Department. They're going to be the Public Health Service. They're going to be the National Guard. We have two armies in this country, one the one we think is the Army, and the other one under the Constitution is the National Guard. And both commissions on which I've served has said the National Guard is the frontline military force to protect this country. Those are citizen soldiers.
So if private sector leaders won't step up, should we have National Guard around chlorine plants and oil pipelines?
That's a possibility. That's a decision President of the United States has to make.
Do you think that kind of debate, that kind of discussion is actually underway?
No.
You know, I have to say, filling in the blanks, it's even more frightening as you flesh out the picture. If private industry is not stepping up, if the government's not even discussing putting government resources into protecting these critical infrastructure pieces, I have a feeling that just as your report says, we're being left hung out to dry.
Well, see, you mentioned the commission's report last January got no attention. Interestingly enough, the media is paying a lot of attention to this task force report on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So if had not been for that task force, I doubt you'd be doing this program tonight, or the Washington Post or New York Times would have had front page stories. So the critical role of the media here is very important. It does, in fact, stimulate citizen concern and public debate. And so you're doing a great job. Thank you very much.
We're glad to be doing it. Juliet Kamm, I know we just have you for a few more seconds. What's the most important thing to get these issues pushed up the agenda and get things done?
I think, unfortunately, my first response is it might take another attack. And I think that's the scary thing that Hardin, Rudman, and others point out, that it's the next attack. However bad September 11th was, the next attack may be unbearable from the perspective of a weapons of mass destruction attack. So I think what it's going to take is, obviously, as Senator Hart says, more media attention. And then I think the kind of quick fixes is the wrong word, but the kind of smaller fixes that are manageable, get the citizenry engaged in this effort, and that keep our eyes on the prize.
Juliet, we've got it. I know we've got to let you go. Thanks for
great.
Joining us tonight. Juliet Kamm, Executive Director of Domestic Preparedness Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Gary Hart. This is On Point.
Austin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former Senator Gary Hart about America the Vulnerable and what hasn't been done in the year since 9/11 to improve homeland security. Are we still a sitting duck? Are we telling ourselves it just won't happen again, or accepting that it will? Is America somehow incapable of sustaining a real homeland defense? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Al's calling from Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Good evening. Good evening, Senator.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I've been working in emergency preparedness with a number of commercial broadcasters for many, many years, and take a very small amount of pride in being responsible for that burping sound you hear in the EAS test these days. I'd have to completely agree with you that there seems to be an emphasis on form rather than function as far as some of the emergency preparedness goals are concerned.
Do you see that directly in your field, Al?
For example, the FCC in response to the Homeland Security issue, established the Media Security and Reliability Council, who has a, it's chartered for 2 years to come up with a replacement for the EAS system or
the emergency broadcasting. Is it working?
Well, strangely enough, at the same time, they canceled the charter for the National Advisory Committee on EAS, which is a group that had a very large amount of institutional knowledge about how the system worked.
Al, I think we got the general drift. Gary Hart, you've said yourself, and so has Senator Rudman, more or less what Al's saying, that we're getting in some fronts more form than function here.
Well, in part, it is the failure of coordination in Washington, and that is the function of not having a single accountable federal official, that is to say a department head, to whom everyone else reports and who is himself or herself accountable to the president, the Congress, and the American people.
Mm-hmm.
So you still have dozens and dozens and dozens of federal agencies scattered all over the federal government, from the Agriculture Department to the FBI, that are not talking to each other. And they've all got a piece of the puzzle, but none of them has the whole, and all of them have to be much more closely coordinating in terms of database, communication systems, and their accountability to the top leadership of this country.
Exactly the kinds of things that we thought Tom Ridge was supposed to make happen.
But he couldn't. You mm-hmm. see, we had, let me give you the experience. In 1974, we had an energy crisis, and then President Nixon appointed, created an Office of Energy in the White House, and it happened to be headed by a former late governor of Colorado, John Love.
Mm.
And it was a disaster, and it wasn't John Love's fault. It was that he had no power. He had no budgetary authority. Nobody paid any attention to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Ridge is a fine man, a fine public servant, and he's doing his best. He has no authority.
Gary Hart, you draw an equation here, as one way of putting it, I guess. You say that if we don't fully prepare, if we don't do our best on Homeland Security, we're ultimately going to pay in a loss of freedoms, in a loss of civil liberties. What's the relationship?
Well, the more the American people are threatened, the more they're going to demand the federal government protect them at whatever cost. And when that demand is made, then civil liberties are sacrificed. It is do whatever it takes and lock up whomever you want to lock up, deny them constitutional rights, search our homes, listen to our phone calls, read our email, just make them quit killing us. So the point is, the greater the threat, the more we as a society are willing to sacrifice those freedoms. And then, of course, the terrorist has won, because that's what the terrorist wants.
And you're saying, after the next attack, exactly that kind of tightening or loss of civil liberties is likely to reemerge?
Yes. No question about it.
It's a scary...
And with each successive attack.
It's a frightening picture, but we appreciate your putting the word out there and all the detail that goes with it. Gary Hart, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure, and thank you for doing the program.
Gary Hart, two-term Democratic U.S. Senator from Colorado and co-chair, along with former Republican Senator Warren Rudman, of a Blue Ribbon panel, the U.S. Commission on National Security, that has issued a new report, America Still Unprepared, America Still in Danger. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, Halloween and horror at the movies. This is On Point.
Tommy, Halloween night, it's when people play tricks on each other. It's all make-believe. I think Richie was just trying to scare you.
I saw the boogeyman. I saw him outside.
There was nobody outside.
There was.
What'd he look like?
The boogeyman.
We're not getting anywhere. All right. The boogeyman can only come out on Halloween night, right?
Right.
Well, I'm here tonight. I'm not about to let anything happen to you.
Promise?
Promise.
It's Halloween, the day of goblins, ghouls, witches, and ghosts, where trick-or-treating, apple-bobbing, and maybe a little mischief is the order of the day. Halloween is the night we take scary theater to the streets. Hollywood puts fright on the big screen every night in a genre that's been selling and evolving for years, from Frankenstein to Friday the 13th to Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare. Here to give us a Halloween night history of the fright flick is our on-point movie maven, Garen Daly, film critic and owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts. Boo and welcome, Garen Daly.
Hi, Tom.
So, ghost stories have been around forever. Hollywood has not. When did Hollywood get its mitts on scary stories?
Almost right away. I mean, you can go right down back into the 20s and the early teens, and you can see where they were making horror movies. Horror movies were just an extension of what was going on in vaudeville and even circuses. One of the most popular films in the 1930s was a film called Freaks by Todd Browning, which did all the circus freaks and made a story about them. So it's always been around, and it's Hollywood realized that it's a cash cow for them. One of the things we can look at through the course of Hollywood's history is how our fears have changed and how Hollywood has responded to them to give us that moment of being titillated and scared inside a theater with 300 or 400 people.
Show us. What's the evolution? Where do we start?
Let's start. I think we should start off with King Kong because first of all, I love the movie. Okay.
This is the classic, the original.
1933. To me, it's all about repressed sexuality. It's about an innocent unleashed in society because, first of all, King Kong was perfect in his environment, but we meddled in there and we brought him in. At the end, he's dying, and the question is whether order is going to be restored to the universe. And you need to have that closing statement that makes it all better again.
Well, Denham, the airplane's got him. Oh, no. It wasn't the airplanes. It was Beauty killed the Beast.
King Kong, 1933, and between Airplanes and Beauty, the Beast is dead. As you say, Garen, at the end of this fright film, order is restored. There are harps playing in the background there.
That's right.
There's a certain simplicity here.
It was a huge, huge film. It was a huge success, and people really got into it and got scared by it. In fact, there were certain scenes in the preview audiences they deleted because they were too scary, and people were fainting in the audiences, just like you hear nowadays about certain films. And all the films in the 30s had that same kind of thing. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Frankenstein, Werewolf, all the way up until World War II. And then World War II, we really had some monsters in the real world, and Hollywood was not making really good horror films then because, obviously, with Hitler out there, what could you need to put on screen?
But they came back after the war, and they came back in a way that's more, at least to my taste, more comprehensible as a fright film.
Yeah. What happened in the 50s, we started to see the first emergence of the youth culture dominating films in these wonderful little sci-fi films. For instance, there was, you know, The Blob with Steve McQueen, I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, and Michael Landon's first film, I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Dr. Brennan, I know what I am, what I become. Help me, doctor, please! I know they're going to catch me, but don't let anyone see me like that. Please, doctor, help me! Please help me!
1957, I Was a Teenage Werewolf. Dr. Brennan, I know what I am.
Well, think about it. What really is happening, you have a teenager whose hormones are totally out of control, and he's regressing back to being a werewolf. He's afraid of his own powers. And you can imagine a teenager in the 50s in a very conforming society feeling the same thing. He goes to this doctor for help. Little does he realize the doctor is actually making him regress. So he's being betrayed.
But here's where Hollywood began to put the hook out with fear films for that teenage audience.
That's right. And you know who picked up on this really nicely? It was Alfred Hitchcock, the master of suspense, the master of horror.
Now, I don't associate him with teen fear flicks.
No, but what he did do is he realized that by seeing what was going on with these teen flicks, he was able to say, there's something else here. We can play with something else. And being the master of suspense and horror, he said, I can take this. And what he took was that loss of control that we are having with nature, that by us meddling inside with the natural order of things, things were getting out of whack and nature was going to come back and haunt us.
It's the end of the world.
Two Bloody Marys, Deke. What actually happened at the school?
Bunch of crows attacked the school kids. It's the end of the world. Thus saith the Lord God unto the mountains and the hills and the rivers and the valleys. Behold, I, even I, shall bring a sword upon you, and I will devastate your high places. Ezekiel chapter 6.
1963, Alfred Hitchcock's Birds. And I have to say, I remember this one from television, probably in replays years later, and it really bothered me.
Well, again, he's telling you that there are going to be things that we, as human beings, are not going to be in control of. And if they start to react against us, we're going to be in big, big trouble. Hitchcock is the person that started that movement within the industry of showing that there is no happy ending. There is no order, and we really do have to be afraid. Night of the Living Dead came out, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Day of the Dead, Evil Dead 2. All these great horror films are all about unrelenting violence.
Just the names raise the hairs on the back of my neck.
Well, they're great films. I love them. I absolutely love them.
The Shining comes along.
Shining comes along. And again, what happens here is that Stanley Kubrick, again, raises the level of what can be done with a horror film with Jack Nicholson and Stephen King's book of The Shining. And in it, we see the disintegration of a person completely. And what's so effective in this film is you really don't know what is real and what's not real and what's really going on in Jack Nicholson's mind. But eventually, we know the guy is absolutely crazy.
Little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in.
Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and we're on our way to real blood and gore now.
Yeah, and there's something else that we need to talk about here. If you listen to that, great sound effects, really good music, excellent acting, great production values, and more importantly, it is a place that we are familiar with. We're no longer in a location that is far away, like in Transylvania or in a weird lab or some, you know, cave someplace.
Regular people, regular setting, big time horror.
That's right, because it's getting closer and closer to our own home. And that's what Kubrick did with The Shining. He made these people normal, everyday people who end up facing incredibly horrible things.
So where does Hollywood horror live now?
Well, it's going in a couple of different directions. We can talk about something like, you know, the fact that there are new small-budgeted films coming out, being generated all the time. There's several coming out this week. There's a film called 1,000 Corpses that's coming out. But one of the things that I'm really enjoying is this kind of new personal horror film, this film where small independent filmmakers have found something, much like George Romero did with Night of the Living Dead. The same thing happened a year and a half ago with Blair Witch Project.
Out of nowhere.
Out of nowhere. Huge. And again, a very personal thing and kind of scary. You show the arrogance of that young generation all of a sudden getting their comeuppance in a horrible way.
I am so, so sorry for everything that has happened. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold and hunted. I love you, Mom and Dad. I am so sorry.
Little film, big hit.
Little film, huge hit. And you're going to see more of that, I think. And I think Hollywood is going to continue to wrap its arms around these horror films, come up with new special effects, and we will still go to the movie theaters because we want to be cleansed.
We want to be cleansed, but as you say, they don't end with cleansing anymore. It's blood and gore right to the end. What does the current state of Hollywood horror tell us about ourselves?
It says that we're in a very difficult time, and I think that if we look closely at the fact that there is no resolution, that we are very anxious as a society and as a culture.
Garen, you scare us. It's Halloween. That's appropriate. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome.
Garen Daly is a film critic, owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. On Point is haunted by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior goblin is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.